You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Thursday, November 9th, 2017. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, the great David Dayan, author of Chain of Title, on why air travel is such a living hell. Hint, it has to do with deregulation. Also on the program today, in the wake of the Virginia results, Republicans' tax plans may be a little bit jumbled. Meanwhile, Trump in China heading to Vietnam to meet Putin and celebrate the four-year anniversary of the making of the P-tape. Meanwhile, the assault on the administrative state rolls on. State Department and Education Departments shockingly understaffed. And speaking of shocking, the three richest Americans in this country own more than the bottom 50% of Americans in this country. AT&T and the DOJ may be headed to court for all the right reasons. And is there a salt loophole for pass-throughs? The House very well may have a tax bill that has a massive hole in it and they don't realize it. And four state AGs to oppose the Sinclair Tribune media merger. And surprise, surprise, seems like some of those classic diehard Trump voters, they don't care about anything except for those damn blackies in the NFL. All this and more on today's program. I don't know why I actually dip in and read those stupid, like every couple of weeks, like I traveled back to the same place I traveled back to 3 months ago, the same place I traveled back to 3 months before that, and then 3 months before that when I was talking to some real Trump voters. I'm going to be vague about who they voted for in the past because I got a thesis going here and I don't want to ruin it by saying they've always basically voted for Republicans anyways. And if there is one person in there who actually voted for Obama the first time, I'm going to make sure you see that. And ostensibly, I'm going to make this about trying to understand folks because it's important that we reach out and have a discourse. And then by the end of the piece, you're going to realize, yeah, they just hate black people.
One of these times, though, there's going to be such a good insight that we all start getting along again.
That's true.
That or they need to share the good barbecue places that they're expensing.
Here is, yeah, exactly. The I don't get the sense that there's a lot of good places left in some of these towns. They sound pretty desperate. And yes, I get it that if you are living in a hopeless area, that sometimes, you know, that will increase your likelihood of taking issue with black people who happen to be football players. I think that's a well-founded dynamic. But, yeah, I don't know. I don't know why I keep reading it. I keep reading those things. But it is, there's something, they're good clickbait. I don't even know why I brought that up. That was the last thing I read before I came on, and it bothered me a little bit. I will, maybe I'll talk a little bit more about that piece later, but maybe perhaps more importantly, and maybe in some ways, just as sort of the flip side of that coin, I got an email from a listener, Tim, who has been living in Virginia for 9 years. He was a local volunteer doing data work and canvassing on 3 different presidential elections in Virginia. He said, however, this is the first year I've ever received a call on an off-year election by the contestants to host volunteers and host and volunteer as a canvasser, etc. This was an activated base that worked, and the contestants worked with us. We hosted a Pariolo volunteer for a month, and when he lost, we decided to work with Northam. By June, Northam had paid organizers in Norfolk, his hometown. One of them had worked with the Clinton campaign, and we'd worked with her in 2016. While she was from Richmond, she understood the local territory of Norfolk. They got volunteers organized by July. By August, people were doing local data entry. He says, this sounds pretty pedestrian, but we had never seen anything like this for a gubernatorial campaign by Dems in Virginia, and this was our third. By early September, the Dems had passed the million doors knocked mark, and it kept rolling from there. In October, you began to hear radio ads clearly aimed at African-American voters that framed their vote for Northam as a rejection of the white supremacists and the events at Charlottesville. Finally, it was clear the Dems had reached out to indivisible unions like the AFL-CIO, SEIU, PACs focused on getting African-Americans involved, and as mentioned earlier, residual networks left by Clinton and Sanders. All this is a long way to say there was a ton of rubber put on the road, and in some cases, it really helped. He goes on to give some examples about increased turnout in these areas. So the bottom line is, folks, that obviously, you know, this is going to take a lot of work, but the work pays off. And you can invest stuff into messaging and whatnot, but at the end of the day, it's going to take a just massive mobilization. It's not just going to be about people are going to be motivated to come out and vote against Donald Trump. That's going to help, but it's going to involve massive mobilization. And like everything he references here are about vestiges of infrastructure that was built for prior races, right? So Pariello, who, and you know, you see a lot of stuff like somebody responded to, I retweeted Dave Weigel's point about saying this is not about, Northam being moderate. In Virginia, he was considered to be the most liberal governor candidate that we've had in generations. And someone wrote back to me, no, not true. They want to pick a fight about Bernie Sanders, Bernie Bros, whatever. Tom Pariello, by everyone's account, who ran against Northam, was, if you could point to a single individual outside of Northam himself, obviously, maybe even more so, that helped, went above and beyond to get him elected. Tom Pariello was that guy. And in addition, the infrastructure, there's a good example. The infrastructure that Pariello created was then just ported over to Northam. And part of that infrastructure came from Bernie and Clinton before then. And so, you know, it's really hard to look to Virginia and come away with anything other than what wins elections are people being engaged. So good news coming out of there. We're still waiting to hear what's happening with these recounts. They've been going back and forth a little bit. They find 100 votes here or something like that. But as far as I know, still Democrats won 14 seats and are four are extant. Four of those seats are extant. So we'll see. Meanwhile, it is now November 9th. We have not started the war on Christmas. I generally like to start that after Thanksgiving because I like to have a nice meal first. But right now is a perfect time to start thinking about what you're going to get someone for the holidays. Hanukkah coming up middle of December. Think about it, folks. Well, I've got a perfect idea for you. Movement watches, MVMT, all that gift-giving anxiety you can disappear with a press of a button. These watches make the perfect purchase for just about anyone in your life. Guy, girl, man, woman. And they only start at only $95. You've heard me talk about MVMT. I'm sure you got yourself a watch if you were smart about it. Now, here's an easy way to finish your holiday shopping. Get an MVMT watch for someone on your list. The holiday shopping season, like I say, is we're here. You can wipe out like half of your anxiety. One click away. Skip the crowds, standing in crazy lines, and you can get your giftees a gift they're going to love. Movement watches start at $95. At a department store, you're looking at $400 to $500 for this. They figured out by selling online, they're able to cut out the middleman and retail markup, providing the best possible price. MVMT watches make a wonderful gift. They're classic design, quality construction, styled minimalism. Nikki still wears hers every day. Over 1 million watches sold in 160 countries. Today, you can get 15% off with free shipping and free returns by going to MVMT.com/majority. This watch has a really clean design and makes a great fashion statement. Now is the time to step up your gift-giving and watch game. Go to MVMT.com/majority. MVMT.com/majority. Join the movement. Get 15% off with free shipping and free returns. All right, going to take a quick break. When we come back, the great David Dayan will be here to discuss. Well, I'm going to talk to him about his big piece on the airline deregulation. May surprise you where that got, where deregulation started of the airline industry. And I think we'll also talk about, you know, like a typical David Dayan. He's got like four pieces out that I want to talk to him about that he's written in the past, I think like 17 hours. Wilbur Ross, I also want to talk to him about this AT&T DOJ possible court involvement. We'll be right back after this. We are back, Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. Is that the John Spencer Blues Explosion? Sort of sounds.
Was the OCs.
I don't know what that means. All right, folks, on the phone, it is always a pleasure to welcome this next young man to the program. He writes at The Intercept. He writes at The New Republic. He writes at The American Prospect. He writes at The Nation Magazine. He is the author of Chain of Title. I left off like 14 other publications that he writes for simultaneously. David Dayan, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Sam. Thank you for calling me a young man.
Well, you know, relatively speaking, we've known each other for a long time, buddy.
That's why I question young.
Well,
the use of the word young.
I first met David when I was a substitute teacher for his junior high class. That's not true. All right. all right. Let's start with of the three pieces that you have written in the past 17 hours that I wanted to talk to you about. let's start with the unfriendly skies, because it is it is a sort of a twofold problem that we have with the airline industry in terms, broadly speaking. One is deregulation, and it led to basically monopoly power that has made airlines, air travel, a sort of a nasty experience, but highly profitable for a few individuals, which is, you know, almost like, it's a huge, it's quite a metaphor for the rest of our economy in many respects.
I would say it's one problem. So, and you have to sort of go back to how the airline industry came up. And, the airline industry paralleled the growth and development of the railroad industry. The railroad industry was at first completely deregulated, and it led inexorably to monopolization. The railroad owners could gouge customers who wanted to put their goods on railroad trains to get them to market and things like that. And so it was decided that what we need is public utility regulation to ensure that railroads aren't discriminating against passengers, to ensure that there isn't this obscene amount of concentration, and to make sure that this public good is being used to the benefit of citizens rather than to the benefit of a few wealthy owners of railroads.
And when you're talking about when you're talking about travel, the implications of a transportation system on society are, like, seems to me fundamentally different than retail, for instance. I mean, right? I mean, it's like
it's vital. It's completely vital. You have to have access to air travel to be a world-class city in America today. Excuse me. There's no other option, really. If you don't have access to air travel, you're not going to be able to attract businesses that do work in the global economy. And so, just like the idea that you needed universal service on the railroads, in the 1930s under FDR, it was decided we need to ensure universal service, a public utility regulation for the airlines. And it was called the Civil Aeronautics Board, and it was put together in 1938. And the idea was that the regulation would guarantee a profit for airlines, but it would say that you had to serve the entire country. In other words, service from Des Moines to Fargo, North Dakota would have to be part of the mix if you wanted a route from New York to Los Angeles, which is more lucrative. So everybody would get service. The entire country would benefit from serving the entire nation. The airlines would be fine because they would be protected. If fuel costs, fixed costs rise, they would be able to raise fares. But if they didn't, they would have to keep those fares low, and the public would benefit as well. And we basically took this away in the 1970s, and it was liberals who took it away.
Let me, before we get to how it went away, I want to just ask you a couple of questions about it. So
sure.
The CAB, or the Civil Aeronautics Board, it guaranteed airlines a 12% profit, you write, on a flight that was only 55% full. So it was, which is, you know, it's significant, right? I mean, because they're half full, you still got to pay for the full, you know, all the operating costs are exactly the same, half full as 100% full. And so they guaranteed them that 12% profit, I presume, was some type of subsidy, right, at the end of the year?
That was essentially the fares that they could charge.
Okay,
they were allowed... You know, it was heavily regulated. The fare prices were very regulated, and they had to be confirmed by the Civil Aeronautics Board. And the target for those fares was to allow and enable a 12% profit on a 55% full flight.
Okay.
So that was the idea.
And so basically there were caps on what the ticket prices could be, but you were guaranteed that 12% profit, right? they're allowed
that
to
was
serve.
Yeah, that was the target. That was the target. And let's just say that from 1938 to 1978, the 40 years of operation for the Civil Aeronautics Board, there was a tremendous amount of growth in commercial aviation. This did not cripple the industry. You know, regulation is supposed to destroy industries. This was the time of incredible growth within the aviation industry. Now, there were a lot of reasons for that, but it's certainly not the case that regulation destroyed what could have been, this burgeoning industry. And in fact, airline fares under regulation, under the Civil Aeronautics Board, dropped at a faster rate than in the first decade after deregulation, if you adjust for fuel costs. So what I'm trying to make the point there is that the entire impetus for deregulation of the airlines was, this is going to bring costs down. We're not going to, really be strict about these fares. You're going to have all this competition, and the airfares are going to drive down. But in fact, what happened is that airfares were going down before deregulation. So that's a very key point, because that's the entire rationale for deregulation. It didn't happen.
So let's go into how why deregulation happened. I mean, you've explained part of the theory, right? I mean, it's like I guess you could look back under those years and say, like, well, there was an absence of an innovation, right? Like, you didn't have satellite TV at that time. I mean, I'm just trying to think of like I remember air flight and air travel, and it really hasn't changed much, except for it's gotten worse. It's just become more miserable. Like the airports are more crowded. The flights are the seats are more crowded. We'll talk more about that as we go on. But so the idea was in 1970, you go through 73, there's an oil embargo, 79, you also have oil shocks, but around that time, the Airline Deregulation Act of 1978 passed unanimously, or almost unanimously, you write. What was the genesis of this?
Well, the genesis really did come from liberals. It came from people like Ralph Nader, who said that the Civil Aeronautics Board was captured by the industry, and it was protecting the industry from competition, which is kind of interesting considering where we are now.
But what was he thinking when he said that? I mean, what was he thinking that it was protecting it from? I mean.
Well, you had these guaranteed profits, right? You had these guaranteed profits in the industry. And the idea was that if you liberated the airline industry from this yoke of regulation, you would have suddenly hundreds of new entrants with new planes that would drop prices severely, and that would force everybody to compete. And through that competition, that would benefit consumers in a significant way. That was the idea of Alfred Kahn, who's really the architect of deregulation. He was a professor at Cornell. Jimmy Carter made him the head of the Civil Aeronautics Board, even though he was out to kill it. And he was really the intellectual ballast for deregulation. And legislatively, the main driver was Ted Kennedy. And Ted Kennedy's staff aide at that time was a guy named Stephen Breyer, who now sits on the Supreme Court. And he really pushed Kennedy to do this, what was seen as a very pro-consumer move to deregulate the airlines to create these price reductions. He was convinced that this would make him sort of a hero to the consumer. There was all this inflation going on in the 1970s. There was malaise, but here we're going to make airfares great again. We're going to make airfares, much lower. And this was going to be a great benefit.
I'm trying to shake off
this group of liberals.
Well, I'm trying to shake off the sort of like my understanding of the airline business in hindsight and just contemplate, like, it didn't it occur to them that like all the airlines are just going to go with the most profitable routes, or they're going to find find efficiencies that are going, all this seems somewhat predictable, but I guess maybe at that time there was just no, there was what people thought,
I mean,
that we would have,
I mean, if you
we'd
really
be floating orbs
into,
by now or something, or what?
Right. If you really read into what economists were saying, in very neutral sounding language, they were saying that these pricing restrictions that were put in by the Civil Aeronautics Board led to quote unquote excessive service for passengers, and airlines were denied quote unquote adequate profits. So it wasn't hidden. They were saying the flyers were, you know, passengers were being too comfortable and corporations were not making enough money. And if you deregulate that, then you would reverse that process. And that's exactly what happened. So there was this sort of self-deception going on among liberals who pushed for this, that this would just be a purely pro-consumer move, when it was very well known from if you read any of the sort of white papers on this subject, it was very well known that the idea was that consumers, passengers were getting too much and corporations were getting too little, and this would rectify that. And guess what? It did.
What happened was
immediately a lot of airlines did go into the space. There was a lot of new entrants, but they almost all went bankrupt within about a decade after these price wars played themselves out. And that led very inevitably, in my view, to this extreme concentration. Today, the top four airlines, Delta, American, United, and Southwest, control 80% of all U.S. routes. If you're talking about a hub like Newark Airport or, Cleveland or Charlotte or Salt Lake City, where one airline controls almost all the routes out of those particular hubs, because that's this new system that we moved to, this hub and spoke system, where you can't get a nonstop to a lot of places. You have to go through the hub. So, and predictably, because you had this monopoly power and concentration, the airline experience got much, much worse. There was no need to compete on quality. You could stuff as many people into the plane as possible, because if you have fixed costs, getting more people onto that plane meant more profits. And so you saw seat pitches go shorter and shorter, and more rows in every inch you take away from your seat and the seat in front of you means another row of planes in the back of the plane. So just figure out what's going to happen there. You're just going to get squeezed and squeezed and squeezed. And we see this, sort of at all levels of the airline industry. Now, the airline industry will tell you, well, fees dropped. We did reduce fees. But of course, that neglects all the ancillary fees that you pay now on an airline, the overhead baggage fee and the change fee. And there's an actual boot camp for ancillary fees that executives in the airline industry go to every year to figure out what new ways they can do to gouge their customers. So this has become a very predictable disaster, in my view.
When I go round trip, when I go to Vegas for that lawyer conference, I get the expanded, whatever they call it, the extra comfort seat one way. That's what I do. It's
right.
Like an extra, I don't know, $50 or something. I splurge on my way home because I think I'm going to be exhausted, and the seats are still, it's insane. It's insane.
The extra comfort seat that's $50 more is what the seat used to be 30 years ago. They've just made every other seat worse so that a normal seat looks comfortable by comparison. this is sort of the incredible ingeniousness of the airline industry to sort of nudge people into paying more and more and more, so that their base prices look quite low, but their ancillary fees go up and up. It's a billion, multi-billion dollar business now of these extra fees that they add on.
I'm still can't wrap my head around what was the sort of theoretical basis from folks like Ralph Nader that this was going to be helpful in some way. Like, because on some way, right, there is, and I've talked to a lot of folks from the antitrust world as of late, mm-hmm. and there is a strain of that in there that also worries about consolidated power with the government, right? That could theoretically,
right?
And I wonder if that wasn't like sort of a part of that, because it's hard for me to understand.
Yeah.
You know, you can say like that there's regulatory capture. Well, you work on the capture part, not the regulatory part, it seems to me.
Right. That's exactly right. I mean, the 70s really were an age of regulatory capture, where that term became very prominent. And Nader's work, while not wrong in many cases, really did lead to that sort of backlash, where the regulatory part of it is what got switched around rather than the capture part of it. There was this belief, and it comes out of the Watergate and some of the things that we saw around uses of government power, that government power became synonymous with this thing we had to be skeptical of and wary of. So it was kind of a bad byproduct of the Watergate age in some ways. But what's so interesting about the Airline Deregulation Act of 78 is that in the statute it says, that the government should still guard against unreasonable industry concentration and excessive market domination. The government still had the power through the Justice Department to block right. airline mergers if they thought that it would create excessive concentration. And, they sort of hemmed and hawed around that. And then really in the last decade, you've seen four major mergers. It was American and U.S. Airways. It was United and Continental. It was Southwest and AirTran, which was another low-cost carrier that was really creating a lot of competition, and you had Delta and Northwest. So you've taken that immediately, just sort of cuts in half the major carriers,
right?
And that all happened in after September 11th, which was a big shock to the system of the airline industry. So government had the ability to prevent this. This wasn't a foregone conclusion necessarily out of deregulation. It was the combination of deregulation and a very lax attitude towards antitrust that has put us in the situation we are in today.
And I would add that migration to that system of hubs also, right, was, I think, unpredicted. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I just recall the last 15, 20 years to be about airlines essentially going into bankruptcy as a way of basically saying, hey, thanks for working for us for 30 years. Remember that pension you thought you had? Bye-bye.
Absolutely.
I mean, this is, I remember when that happened to the United pilots, and it was, I mean, just, I remember taking calls from, maybe it was like mm-hmm. 2006, maybe it was, that I remember taking calls from people who were just like, I worked for 30 years. And
it's absolutely true, and thank you for bringing that up, because the effect on workers of this concentration is definitely apparent. They use the bankruptcy process to shed pensions, to shed what they call legacy costs. Across the board, wage cuts of between 30% and 40% for a lot of personnel in the industry. It's not really even a middle class income. The regional airlines that service the majors now, you can have a pilot there that makes $20,000 a year. Do you really want your pilot to be a low wage worker in that respect. It's really been crushing to the workers who service this industry, who are significant. And you know, that's just another byproduct of when you concentrate the industry and suddenly there are less companies who are bidding for those services. They're going to do what they can to get out of paying for those services. And the other thing that it brings up is that this is an industry that's dominated by the desires and beliefs of shareholders on Wall Street.
Of course.
And yes. And this has, you know, there was a fairly celebrated case just a few months ago when American Airlines, the CEO, said that he was going to come out and raise salaries for his flight attendants and pilots because they were below the industry average. And Wall Street went nuts. And they didn't just drop American stock. They dropped the stocks of all airlines across the board because American Airlines decided they were going to pay their workers a little better. And the quotes are quite amazing. I mean, the quotes from Wall Street analysts saying, you know, that labor's getting everything. The shareholders are getting the shaft again.
I have the Kevin Crissey quote right in front of me.
Yeah, go ahead.
He says, Kevin Crissey, an analyst from Citi, said, "This is frustrating. Labor's being paid first again. Shareholders get the leftovers." It's just
exactly.
Unbelievable. And J.P. Morgan's Jamie Baker said the action establishes a worrying precedent in our view, both for the American and for American and the industry. Like, you're going to start paying the people who work for you? This is dangerous stuff we're heading into. This,
And the reason that they do that is because it worked. Like, you know, there was another case that I mentioned in the piece about JetBlue.
Yep.
And the CEO of JetBlue wanted to equip his airlines, his planes, so that they were actually comfortable, so that you could actually manage to sit in the seat for 3 hours. And he said that we're going to compete on quality. We're going to give people a good ride and they're going to want to fly on our planes. And Wall Street again went nuts and they said, you can't do this. You're costing your company money. You're costing us, the shareholders, money. And after a couple years of battle on this, JetBlue backed down. They went back to sort of the industry standard of squeezing the passengers by, you know, making the experience demonstrably worse. So Wall Street has this,
and they got rid of Barger. He stepped down, right?
They even got rid of the CEO. Yeah, they forced the CEO.
It was like he was Serpico in some way. Like honestly, it was like it's like you can't do this, man, because the other airlines are going to follow suit. I mean, so what's the solution to this one? I mean, is there can you bring back something like CAB, like the Civil Aeronautics Board?
I mean, I think you have to sort of first start by changing the mindset here. The choice is not between regulation and deregulation. The choice is between regulation in the public interest by elected representatives and regulation by CEOs and investors. That's the choice, because what we have now is regulation by CEOs and Wall Street investors. And when you get that, you get worse service that you're paying through the nose for, where you can be pulled off the plane at a moment's notice if the company deems that is something that needs to be done. I think you need to reimpose some quality of service standards. There was a very good lawsuit by a consumer organization called Flyers Rights that you know forced the FAA to step in and put some rules and protections around the incredible shrinking seat that we see. It forced them to do it. The FAA didn't want to do it, and Flyers Rights won this lawsuit to force some reasonable regulation around.
But basically,
that.
Because of safety issues, is my understanding, right? They said, like, look, if you keep putting more people in these planes, it's not safe based upon the own.
Yeah, you're
going to
get blood clots out of people. Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, you know, we need to do that. We need more airports. We haven't built a major airport in this country since 1995. That would increase the ability for more passengers, more planes, more capacity. You need to open up slots in existing airlines, in existing airports, so that one company doesn't control all the gates in a particular airport. We need to mandate some sort of reasonable service universally throughout the country, so that everyone can share in this public good of air travel. And we need, if that means we need to sort of subsidize the less profitable routes with the more profitable routes, then so be it. I really do think we need to go back to regulation in the public interest rather than in the interest of corporate executives and Wall Street shareholders.
Well, we'll put that on the list.
Exactly.
But with that said, I mean, it's a fascinating
history.
And
the last thing I would say here is that this is how the economy works right now, right?
Yes.
I mean, the things that we're seeing in the airline industry are no different than what we see throughout the entire economy over the last 40 years. You're talking about inequality, consolidation in the hands of a few, deregulation, workers getting the shaft, regulation by Wall Street. All of the factors around airlines and the airline industry are present in the rest of our economy. So really the answer is that we need a new paradigm for this American version of capitalism that we have, or else, every other industry is going to suffer the same fate as the airline industry.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's, you know, for me, the through line in stories like this is inevitably that you've got CEOs and board of directors who are paid based upon stock price, and they have they have basically a cottage industry, and so their concerns are, you know, basically the side bet at the table, and it really is their incentive structure is misaligned with the incentive structure of somebody who wanted to build a long-term sustainable business that would nurture a consumer base and provide for its workers.
Absolutely.
And people can go back and listen to any Bill Lozonik interview that I've done, which covers that. But all right, let's move from that story, because you have a couple. Let's stay within the realm of antitrust, because I noticed on Twitter you're pushing back on this a little bit. All are aware of the AT&T Time Warner merger that has been in the offing for quite some time. Those of us who have very good memories remember Jeff Fuchs, whatever the CEO of Time Warner's name was, saying at some type of probably around about a year ago, right after Donald Trump won the election, saying at some tech interview, I don't know, convention or something, that he was not worried about Donald Trump's threat to the First Amendment, you know, vis-a-vis his attacks on CNN. He was really worried about the Democrats and their push for repeal of Citizens United, and thereby signaling that he understood what was going to be happening under the Trump administration. You've got to kiss this guy's ass. He didn't have his own Forbidden City to take him to convince Donald Trump that he should just give him the store. But the story that AT&T is pushing right now is that Donald Trump is forcing AT&T to sell CNN because he doesn't like CNN and he's trying to punish them. But in fact, the real story is far more complicated and has to do with media concentration.
Yeah. And I'm going to have a larger piece at this at The Nation maybe later today or tomorrow. But
of course,
yes. First of all, it's not at all clear and probably untrue that the Justice Department asked AT&T to sell CNN in isolation. That's not what other outlets have reported. In fact, they've reported that they gave AT&T a choice. You can sell Turner Broadcasting, which is bundles CNN with TNT and TBS and I think about 20 different channels.
Yep.
You can sell that to divest, or you can sell DirecTV, which AT&T owns, which is a distributor of satellite television program. So, you know, these two are these are two different things. So under one option, AT&T gets to keep CNN. So I don't understand the...
So you can either own the content or the distribution network. You cannot own both because then you've created a closed system.
That's correct, and that's what they're saying. And, you know, this came up in the Comcast-NBC deal.
Yes.
Right? The idea was if Comcast owned NBC, then it could favor NBC programming on its own network or increase the price of licensing NBC programming for somebody else's distribution network. And that's the fear here, too. Now, how did they solve the Comcast problem? Well, Comcast promised to some what they call behavioral remedies, where they promised that they would not, you know, favor their own content. It turned out it was impossible to monitor that. The FCC wasn't able to monitor it. The DOJ wasn't able to monitor it. And what we know from the new guy at the Department of Justice's antitrust division, Makan Delrahim, who was confirmed a couple months ago, he said, well, these behavioral remedies, they don't work. We have no ability to figure them out. So the only other step, unless the Justice Department is going to cancel the deal and say you can't do it, which, you know, I would say they should. But short of that, the only remedy is divestiture, saying, okay, if we can't track whether you're or not you are favoring your own content and hurting your rivals, then we're going to say you can't own both. And there's really ample precedent for this. In fact, there was a forced divestiture of this type when Time Warner bought Turner Broadcasting
right.
in 1996. There's plenty of precedent for this. And I think that the media, because there's this assumption that Donald Trump is doing everything, you know, because of his own ego, which most of the time is correct, that automatically this is another example of him punishing his enemies by trying this divestiture of CNN. I really think that goes way ahead of the evidence here. Indeed, it would be a good idea to force this divestiture, regardless of where Trump's going to go with it. Now, the problem is that Trump has pretty much expressed his loathing of CNN, has said that he would, you know, block this merger while on the campaign trail. And so there's an appearance of impropriety such that if AT&T, who is leaking this idea to the press, if they decide to fight this in court, clearly their legal strategy will be, we are being punished because of a vendetta by Donald Trump.
Right.
And a federal court may accept that as correct. And so this is actually sort of a tragedy, I think, this story, because here we have the Justice Department finally going further in terms of trying to prevent media consolidation. But because they have a loudmouth in the White House, they may be blocked from actually doing this thing that would be salutary.
It also occurs to me, what happens when Donald Trump realizes that we have a functional Justice Department? Will he not be like, wait, what?
Right.
That's not what we're supposed to be doing. I mean, when Steve Bannon hears about this, isn't he going to be like, wow, who didn't fire those guys yet?
Also, it's not clear to me that selling CNN along with Turner Broadcasting to a willing purchaser would hurt CNN. Why would that hurt CNN?
I mean, Sinclair Media goes and buys it, what's the problem? I mean, that's the, you know.
Well, that would be a larger problem.
Right,
but,
exactly.
But it wouldn't affect the bottom line of CNN. Like, CNN would thrive. I just don't see the rationale here that this is somehow indicative of vindictiveness on the part of Donald Trump.
I mean, it may be a function of that as well, but it's still good policy, it seems to me. I mean, this concentration is crazy. All right, well, let's just talk about one other coincidence that we have. It turns out Wilbur Ross, he was caught up in the Paradise Papers dump. I don't know if I would call it a dump necessarily, revelations maybe. Ross, there, people have made issue of the fact that he has extensive business ties with Putin's family. And then there's other stories that he's been lying about his money because he wants to be on the Forbes 500 list or something like that, which is also sort of just insane. But it also seems that while he's been Commerce Secretary, he's been slightly taking advantage of the fact that he's Commerce Secretary and basically wheeling and dealing with just about every part of the Commerce Secretary's portfolio. Would cover, right? I mean, have I got that right?
Well, so in his at the beginning in his ethics agreement, Wilbur Ross says, "I am divesting myself of all these interests, but I'm not going to divest myself of this one area." It was actually two areas, but one is around mortgage lending, which really isn't Commerce Department's purview. But the other one, he said, is I'm going to keep these investments in transoceanic shipping companies. Now, the Commerce Department is, and particularly in this administration, is concerned with issues of global trade, which involves putting items on a ship and taking them across an ocean. Some would say transoceanic shipping. The Commerce Department logo has a ship on it.
Is it one of Wilbur Ross's? Did he switch it out?
It's his yet. I don't think they've actually gotten the logo guy to make that change.
But we're waiting for the flag to come back, for the Commerce Secretary flag that will signify he's in the building.
Right. So it was ridiculous from the beginning. Why would you let the Commerce Secretary still hold these investments in shipping? And indeed, one of the first actions of Wilbur Ross is he negotiated this deal to expand exports of liquefied natural gas to China, which is a huge untapped market for LNG. Now, it turns out one of the companies that he has an investment in, Navigator, has a huge fleet of ships that transport natural gas. So, I mean, the idea that he was allowed to do this to begin with is just ridiculous. It's a walking conflict of interest. And what I learned in my report is that the ethics officer who signed off on this, who said, yes, you can keep owning investments in shipping companies, even though you're running the Commerce Department. This guy was an alternate ethics official within the Commerce Department who, within the last 2 months, Wilbur Ross promoted himself. It's his job to choose his own ethics officer. So that
you've
really
got my kind of ethics.
Exactly. A complete failure of the ethics process.
All right. Well, to be fair, let's put the logo back up there. All right. So Wilbur Ross owns a shipping company that he just okayed, but there's also an eagle and a lighthouse on the seal.
Yeah, the lighthouse is watching for the ship.
All right, fair enough. But does he own eagles?
So it's really two out of three of the iconography on the Commerce Department logo having to do with transnational shipping.
Wow. Well, I mean, one would, it seems like that would be an ethics violation, except for what they've done, it appears, is to just redefine what ethics mean, essentially, by hiring the guy in charge of ethics.
Right. And this is sort of a larger failure of just the entire structure of it. If you can have the head of the department choose his or her own ethics official, then that's just sort of an invitation to this kind of abuse.
Is there an IG, like an internal investigator associated with Commerce? Well,
yeah, there's an inspector general, and Senator Richard Blumenthal has called for an inspector general investigation of this whole business. And,
does Wilbur Ross suspect... get to appoint his kid that or something like that? Like Wilbur Ross Jr., our inspector general?
Yeah. Yeah, I think the inspector general is named Rilbur Wass, interestingly enough.
That is the, there's that.
There is that. And it turned out, by the way, that American Public Media added to this by saying it's not just Navigator, which was the shipping company profiled in the Paradise Papers, but Wilbur Ross owns a stake in 75 different shipping vessels across multiple companies, many of which transport the types of goods that will be benefited by the opening of LNG exports to China.
Who better to run the Commerce Department? Who better? He knows it. He knows it.
That makes him smart.
Yeah. Well, it's not dumb. I mean, if you have the ability to do that stuff, I guess that's what they call business, right? It much easier. Well, David Dayan, as always, learned so much in what you're writing and talking to you about it. I can't thank you enough for coming on.
All right. Thank you.
We'll link to those pieces. And of course, to your secret site, which I'm sorry, I'm going to tell people about it. It is David Dayan's Tumblr, daviddayan.tumblr.com. And if you go there, do you have a sign up for your email blast?
I'm not sure if it's right there, but you just go to tinyletter.com/DavidDayan and you can sign up to the newsletter, where I link to all the stories I put out and then give you a little bit extra. I send that out twice a week, and that's another good way to keep up.
All right, there you go. David, thank you so much. I appreciate it, buddy.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. Oh, boy. Just trying to remember Virginia. Just trying to remember Virginia.
I've always got the 8th of November.
That's right. Just trying to remember how I felt at whatever it was, 9 p.m. that night or 10 p.m. There was nothing, no better feeling than being able to text Larry Murphy and say, dude, I think actually Virginia's looking really good. All right, folks, just a reminder, it is your support that makes this show possible. By becoming a member, you're paying for the free show. If you have the financial means to do so, please head over there at jointhemajorityreport.com. And as a way of saying thank you, we give you extra content every day. I mean, I bet in 2017 there was probably one day maybe that we didn't do extra content. Do you think there was?
Well, like a freebie day maybe, or a day we were off.
A day we were off maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe one day where you didn't get extra member content, but still, please give me a break.
They still got a show that day.
They still got a show, right? It's not the extra show. So that's our way of saying thank you. And of course, if you do not have the financial means, and you want the second half, fun half, we call it. You can simply head to, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. We will make a deal with you. We make the best deals. The best deals. We will put you in charge of our membership. We'll make you the guy in charge, or the gal in charge of regulating our memberships. So head over to jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, a reminder, if you have yet to take our survey, I think we're only going to do this for a couple more days. MajoritySurvey.com. This is very helpful to us. If you are a freebie listener and you don't want to become a member and whatever, go. You will assuage your feelings of guilt and nagginghoodness by going to MajoritySurvey.com. Take the survey. That'll help us out. That'll put you in good stead for like a week and a half. This breaking news, it is being reported by the Washington Post Deputy National Politics Editor, Peter Walston, on Twitter, but I guess there's a piece in Washington Post. Woman says Roy Moore is the Republican Senate candidate in Alabama for an election that takes place almost 4 weeks to the day from here. The first week of December, if I remember correctly, maybe December 10th or something like that. Alabama resident Lee Korfman said that in 1979, when Moore was an assistant district attorney, he brought her to his home and touched her sexually as a 14-year-old. She was 14 years old. This is a big story here. You put this picture up. Do you have the link to the story? This is a serious story here. Lee Korfman said that when she was 14 years old, an older man approached her outside a courtroom in Etowah County, Alabama. She was sitting on a bench with her mother, they both recall, when the man introduced himself as Roy Moore. He was a 32-year-old assistant district attorney. He struck up a conversation, Korfman and her mother say, and then offered to watch the girl while her mother went inside for a child custody hearing. God. Holy cow. Alone with Korfman, Moore chatted with her and asked her for her phone number. Days later, he picked her up around the corner from her house, drove her 30 minutes to his home in the woods, told her how pretty she was, and kissed her. On a second visit, she says he took off her shirt and pants. She was 14 years old at the time. Oh, my God. I wanted it over with. I want it out, she remembers thinking. Please get this over with. Two of Korfman's childhood friends say she told them at the time that she was seeing an older man. One says Korfman identified the man as Moore. Wells, this is the mother, says her daughter told her about the encounter more than a decade later, as Moore was becoming a more prominent local judge. Aside from Korfman, three other women interviewed by the Washington Post in recent weeks say Moore pursued them when they were in between the ages of 16 and 18, and he was in his early 30s. None of the women say that Moore forced them into any sort of relationship or sexual conduct. Jeez. Wow. Yeah. That is, this story is obviously breaking, but man.
It's always those guys. Stories like that about, in the Hasidic community, about like stories from Iran and Saudi Arabia. It's always like those fanatics. I mean, not always, but just doesn't surprise me at all.
That's
very disgusting.
I mean, we shall see what happens. I mean, this is a pretty well-reported story. You know, the Washington Post are gonna, they knew how, I imagine, what a bomb this was gonna be. That story dropped about 10 minutes ago.
Now, I'm not saying that what he did was right, but it's another distraction from Don Brazil's revelations about the DNC.
That's,
way to go. We have keep covering for the criminality.
This is going to be, the real question is going to be, if a guy is doing that to a 14-year-old girl,
what
else is he doing?
Well, right? There's going to be more stories of this.
And how did he rule on cases like that?
That was the only time.
But also, what was the, I mean, the yeah, it's just insane.
As a 32-year-old man who's targeting, I mean, that is predator behavior right there. Telling the mother, go inside for your hearing. I'll stay with your daughter. Getting her phone number at that time. That's full-on predator behavior. And if this story is true, and I'll tell you something, one of the things that Moore would know this as a former prosecutor, that you look for is contemporaneous telling of the story to people at that time. When you're talking about things that have happened 20, 30 years ago, you look for people who can verify that that story was told contemporaneous with the thing that's going on at that time. And so it's going to be interesting because a story like this comes out. It's quite possible in the next couple of days we're going to hear of more women who come forward at this point. And
where was Luther Strange's oppo? It's kind of amazing.
I mean, that is
the establishment was behind Strange. How do they not dig this up in the primary? And then would it have helped or hurt in a Republican primary?
It doesn't seem like. Well, I look, couldn't help I'm not that. Convinced. So I'm not convinced. I'm not convinced that this is really going to seriously implicate.
Oh, I don't think so.
The election.
It's fake news,
at this
man.
Point.
No,
exactly.
It's hey, he likes them a little young, but at least he hates the Muslims. I think they're. But on the other
he
hand,
he has repented.
That election. Oh, that would work too. That election's more competitive, apparently, than I thought it would be. So let me just put out. In the spirit of Tuesday, could you imagine if Roy Moore loses and gets indicted for the a thing of beauty?
I told everybody Luther Strange. That's why I liked Big Luther. I said that
Big
and
Luther,
nobody listened to
Big
me.
Luther doesn't like. No. What you do is you go up to a 14-year-old and you say, "Soon you'll be hot enough." You don't go at them directly.
Steve
Roy,
Bannon,
sicko.
Steve Bannon,
sicko.
Though, will gave a comment and said, "This is what." Candidates need to do. They need to embrace Donald Trump's ethos more thoroughly.
He's a predator, just like Josh who say no Mexicans.
If Ed Gillespie had adopted the Trump ethos,
Gillespie went to a 15-year-old and said, "Oh my God, they didn't invent the term barely legal for nothing," he would have won.
All right,
with
folks.
The Trump ethos.
We're going to head into the fun half. Don't forget, just coffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Also, you can buy stuff at our affiliate links at majorityreportkickback.com. Don't forget to check out TMBS Tuesday night's. Mm-hmm. Tuesday night's show, ContraPoints and Ben Dixon. You can find it online. iTunes, other places. All right, we'll be right back. 646-257-3920. Oh, just one reminder. Tomorrow, early show. Starting at 10:55 tomorrow a.m. East Coast time. So basically around 11 East Coast time tomorrow, early show. See you in the fun half.